Welcome to the Kingdom Crossroads Podcast with Pastor Robert Thibodeau. Using an interview format, Pastor Bob will introduce you to men and women whose ministries are impacting this world with the gospel, and will also provide commentary and insight on end-time prophetic events we now see happening in the news. Now here is Pastor Robert Thibodeau.
Hello everyone everywhere, this is Pastor Bob Thibodeau. Welcome back to part two of our great interview with the CSO of Cinema Intelligence and the author of a best-selling book called The Outlier Approach. This is Kevin Hong. Who's Kevin Hong? Well, you may have heard about him building a company by living out of his van, traveling over 200,000 miles over 2 years, not just by himself, but with several other people living in the van with him, just to make sure their company was a success. We're jumping right back into this interview with Kevin Hong. If you missed part one, go back and catch up. But here is part two. Hey, man, now, there's a story that I'd like you to tell about the guy that wanted to, you know, work with you, but he was too tall to live with you in the van. I started laughing when I said that, when I read that.
No, it was great. I mean, we had so much media coverage. We were on CNBC, The Verge, LA Times. I mean, you name it, we were probably on it. And at this time, we were getting emails from women asking, like, can you guys open up a woman band? We want to do this thing too. And there was also, like, Ivy League students, previous investment bankers that wanted to live in a van and take, like, a steep pay cut of, like, 50 to 70%. And I remember there was this one candidate we loved, and he was just had great interview skills, very good interpersonal skills. He shows up to the office. He's about 6'9". And we're looking at him. We're just like, "Wait, sorry, dude. I mean, where do we fit your legs? We need to remove the passenger seat up front." And, you know, we try to kind of picture it and how it would work. He even volunteered to have his legs sticking out the window.
That's
what. We just couldn't make it work, unfortunately. So,
my goodness. Now, you mentioned all the media coverage you're getting. What started the media blitz?
So what was really unique about DealFlix was that before even the man van, we were trying to get ourselves on the news a lot. And that, the reason behind it was we weren't that good at digital marketing. So my business partner and I, when we started it, we didn't know anything about search engine marketing or search engine optimization. We had mostly a background in sales. I had a background in, you know, sales and finance. It wasn't really tech. It wasn't really much of a tech background. So we were thinking, well, how do we get free publicity? And I remember after about a month that we launched, we got really sick and tired of handing out flyers because that was our go-to marketing strategy at that time and just doing some like social media posts, et cetera. So it wasn't robust enough. So I was thinking, well, how do I get ourselves in the news? So I started looking up reporters and editors and writers for the local newspaper, like the Oakland Tribune and the Santa Cruz Sentinel. And I start, you know, reaching out to them, and they keep, like, I give them the most visionary pitch I possibly could. And they keep hanging up on me. They're just not interested in the story. Click, 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 click. And I figured, well, each time when they hung up, they would mention, hey, I have a deadline to meet. And then you start noticing these patterns. I'm like, oh, okay, so this person has a deadline Wednesday at 5 o'clock every week. And then that person has a deadline Thursday. So I thought, okay, what if I wrote the press release and I kind of tailor it to their readership? And then I call them a day before and say, hey, Joe, you got a deadline tomorrow. I already wrote the story for you. This will save you so much time. So wow. I actually reversed my pitch. And then within 2 weeks, we got an article on the Santa Cruz Sentinel. And then I used that same strategy to get us on the Oakland Tribune. And then about a month later, we were on CNBC. So even before we were doing the whole man van thing, we had a lot of media coverage. So when we were doing the man van campaigns, we were, you know, covered by Korea Times in Korea, wow. Even the news in China, Germany's NDR, it's like their NPR radio station. So then we had so much coverage when the man van was happening, because then it became this like really cool thing to live in a van. And it really helped with ticket sales and fundraising and what have you.
I have to ask, how was it living in the van for those 2 years? You mentioned, you know, taking showers and the gyms and all that, and that, you know, you had to read the body language, basically, of your partners to let, you know, figure, okay, well, they need a break now or something like that. How did you, living in the van, how did you decompress, I guess you could say, from the stresses that you were going under?
Yeah, so we had some nights where we would just go out. I mean, you know, we had a young group of guys all in their 20s. We had some epic nights, you know, partying in, you know, like Memphis or New Orleans or New York City or what have you. But mostly we decompress at the gym a lot because you want to shower like at least twice a day when you're living in a van, like one in the morning and one in the evening, because you want to keep your house clean. You don't want it to stink up.
Right.
So when you're in that
your office.
Your house, your office, your transportation, your bed, your movable bed, right? Mobile bed. And so when you're in that kind of environment, you start going to the gym twice a day and you start getting really, really fit and really like lean and mean. And we were like addicted. We kind of became gym rats. And I'm not really like a guy that really enjoys going to the gym, but I was down to about 10% body fat, and I was extremely fit. And you start to eat perishable food like apples, bananas, where you don't have to cook. Okay. And then we would eat Korean barbecue a lot because it was all you can eat. We would eat Indian lunch buffets because it was all you can eat as well. We would eat soup plantation, sweet tomato. It's just really healthy overall in general. And it was actually a really fun lifestyle because I talk about in my book called Reality Distortion. So once your body and mind starts to adapt, you just start to accept that as a reality. So for me, after living in a van for 2 years, I lived in a van for an extra year, even after the man van campaigns were over, because I was so used to living in a van. It was just really weird for me to be around so much space. Like I couldn't be around a normal room anymore because I'm like, what do I do with all this living space? It's so weird. I want to just crawl back in the van and sleep there. Wow. It was really interesting how your brain just fundamentally changes the way it just thinks about things. So that was a fascinating experience for me.
So you did not have a kimchi refrigerator then in the van?
No, we didn't. I mean, we even thought about it, but then, with the refrigerator, it would just take up too much space because we had our clothes in there, we had our food, we had laptops. I mean, it wasn't. You have to really have like meetings about what could stay in the van and what couldn't, just to make sure we optimize on whatever space we have left.
How'd you keep your computers charged, your laptops?
Oh, so when we're working, we would typically work at a Starbucks, okay, or, you know, at, for example, Lifetime Fitness. They have like lounging areas, so that was like our favorite gym to go to. It was kind of like an Equinox, mm-hmm, if you will, like bigger. Or we would go work in a lot of hotel lobbies. So hotel lobbies, they don't really check. And, you know, as long as you dress nice, you know, look business casual, they'll assume that you're staying at the hotel.
Okay.
So we just charged there and we would just go back. And it's the safest place to sleep. So they say Walmart parking lots, but then, you know, you're so far from the Wi-Fi. I don't think Walmart allows Wi-Fi. But hotel lobbies, they have security going around. Mm-hmm. So if you want to ever sleep and you live in a van, I highly recommend hotel parking lot because it's safe and they have cameras and what have you. So
did you keep your original team members for those 2 years on the road, or did you have to hire new help along the way? How'd that work?
So we had Evan, who was a junior co-founder, and then he was there for about a year, and then he had to he wanted to move on and try a new business. So, you know, he was a great teammate. I mean, he was the first man van person. And without Evan, I don't think DealFlix would have gotten to where it was. And he was just extraordinary. And then we had two other teammates that lasted about 3 months. unfortunately, the man van is not for everyone. And one of these teammates, he was just addicted to candy. So he would have all these Jolly Ranchers just spilling out of his pocket and Skittles, and Twizzlers and stuff like that. And he would never eat anything that was green. Mm. So about a month in, he's just constantly sick. Because when you're living in such tight space, if one person gets sick, we all get sick.
Yeah, I remember
So I had to almost micromanage and tell everyone, dude, we all have to eat our, you know, broccolis and, you know, vegetables and carrots and stuff like that. And after a while, since he was continuously getting sick, we had to let him go and, you know, it didn't work out. Chris was there till the end. I mean, he was an extraordinary man type of guy as well. And then Ryan finished it off. So, you know, we had about like five people, three of them part of our core, and then two people that didn't last quite long.
Tried it out for a little while and didn't work out.
Tried it out. Yeah, exactly.
Let's fast forward a little bit. What happened that made you leave DealFlix?
Yeah. So I had a business partner and, you know, a business partner that happened to be one of my first friends when I moved to America. He was actually my upline when I started the network marketing business.
Okay.
And I transitioned from, you know, going back to school, then launching a career in finance, and then going back and helping running DealFlix. But I think, unfortunately for him, he continued to do network marketing for about 10 years. Mm-hmm. So after Excel went, after he left Excel, he tried another networking business, then he tried another one, then he tried another one. And he didn't have a lot of experience outside of network marketing. So as our company grew from, you know, doing, you know, 50,000 a year to 500,000 a year to 7 million a year at the time I departed, I felt like we needed, you know, maybe a new management team. And keep in mind, about 50% of CEOs do get replaced in Silicon Valley. And I wasn't pushing for that, but I felt like we needed advisors, we needed veteran help. And the trouble was that when I was making these suggestions, he would take it very personally. And he would get frustrated and see it as a personal betrayal when I brought some of these issues to our investors and, you know, additional shareholders. And then one of our investors even suggested to do marriage counseling. So we actually ended up doing marriage counseling for about 3 months.
Wow.
Obviously, it wasn't really a personal issue. I felt like we needed, you know, a new team, possibly a new management team to help us take our company to the next level. And keep in mind, some of these Silicon, you know, Valley investors, they've seen or helped companies exit at $1 billion or more. They have right. that experience. And my thought was like, well, the oldest guy on our team is like 32. We could definitely use some experience here. And when I brought it up to some investors, a lot of them agreed with me. And then he took it as, I guess, like a personal betrayal, and then he ended up ousting me from DealFlix, unfortunately. So, you know, it was a very unfortunate situation that I was in, but I just wanted to do what was best for DealFlix.
Yeah.
And it was unfortunate that he interpreted it that way. But, you know, I think that's what happens when you have just a bunch of young kids running companies in Silicon Valley.
Did you get bought out? I mean,
no, I'm still the second.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm still the second largest shareholder in the company.
All right.
So, you know, I do, you know, try to help them if I can. But, you know, my ex-business partner and I were actually not on speaking terms. I try to reach out and amend things, but I mean, you know, he just fired me over the phone on a Saturday and, you know, it was kind of rough the way he did it.
It's kind of like baseball, you know. Lose the game, get back to the hotel, find out your lock has changed.
You're fired,
you know. But
yeah.
Okay. Well, let's go to your book, The Outlier Approach. I mean, that's a unique title for a book. It's quite appropriate, but you know, how did you come up with that name of the book?
Yeah, no, that was a tough one, and I'm still debating whether I should change it or not.
I thought it was a great name.
Actually, as an author, you always you constantly think like, "Oh, I could have done better." You know, why did I do this? Why did I say it like this way? And I really like the term outlier because I wanted to have a word that describes someone who was special, who was different, but wasn't necessarily an underdog. And that's how I kind of see myself. I mean, I've had these, I guess, what some people might say disadvantages moving back and forth from Korea and America and not being able to speak either language fluently for a long time. But that in turn became this huge advantage later on in my career. So I wanted to use a term that really portrayed someone who was just unorthodox, but was still someone who could potentially be someone special. And that's what I stuck. That's why I stuck with the term outlier.
Yeah, I mean, it is very apt what you're doing. I mean, it's not every person that decides to grow a multi-million-dollar company from the back of a van. And I mean, that's definitely an outlier approach. And you know, I just when you look at the story of Steve Jobs and Bill Gates and all that, you know, starting in a garage. I mean, that's the outlier approach, you know, the American dream, you know, type thing.
Exactly.
Now, what was the purpose that you had in writing this book?
Yeah, well, I really wanted to use that energy. So when I got fired from my own company, for the first time in my life, I actually had time and almost freedom to look through and read all my journals that I started after I moved back to the States from Korea. Okay. And, you know, I would laugh and cry, and I just saw this, you know, almost this character arc of, you know, like my English. First of all, my English was improving every year. And then I was assimilating more and all these mistakes that I made. And I'm like, wow, you know, I've always wanted to write a book. What if I wrote a book to help, you know, younger people that were in my situation where, you know, they didn't know what they wanted. They might have parents who aren't really familiar with, you know, the industries that are changing in this day and age. Or culturally speaking, they were maybe immigrant parents that just didn't know how the American system worked. So I was thinking, well, I wanted to write something to help these people opposed to staying bitter and angry about me getting fired from my own company. Mm-hmm. So I started to write and I wrote and I wrote and I wrote. And then I started sharing it with my friends. And then, you know, I was asking my friends, like, hey, you know, after I write this, should I hire a ghostwriter or something? Like, I'm not sure about my writing. And the funny thing is, when you write a journal, you don't share it with anyone. Right. So I didn't share journals, and I still haven't for 17 years. So I didn't know how much my writing skills have improved, because in my mind, I'm still thinking like I'm this guy from Korea still trying to improve or had to. So you don't think you're a good writer. So that my friends were like, English, dude, who wrote this? Yeah, I'm writing in broken English. Like, is a preposition supposed to be here? Or is there a misspelling somewhere? I'm just really confused. Right. So I'm writing this. And my friends are telling me, dude, who's your ghostwriter? Who wrote this for you? And they just couldn't believe I wrote it. And that's when I realized, wow, maybe I could actually write a really good book. And I submitted some pieces to, you know, Forbes, and you know, they got published. And then Inc. magazine gave me my own column, The Nonconformist Way of Doing Business. Awesome. And then, you know, one of my LinkedIn articles got published on CNBC. And then that kind of gave me the courage to just kind of finish it off, and that's exactly what I did.
Amen. How long did it take you to write the book?
It took me only 2 months to get about 60-70% of it done, because that was mostly my story. But then the last 100 pages or so that I interview really interesting people, like, mm-hmm. you know, Kevin Johnson, CEO of Udemy, or Q Lee, who was the manager of Psy that helped bring Gangnam Style to the U.S. after teaming up with Justin Bieber's manager. Like, getting those interviews were the tricky part, and just kind of making
sure how you got those interviews.
Well, it helps because I work in entertainment. You know, you always know someone who knows someone. And then secondly, when I started writing for, you know, some of the bigger publications, it was just a lot more easier to get these interviews in. So that's kind of what took the project a little bit longer, but it really helped round out all the stories together.
You mentioned Psy. Did you ever meet Psy? I know you're into K-pop and all that stuff.
No, okay. I haven't. Well, I haven't been, you know, into K-pop for about 20 years now. But I would love to meet Psy one day.
I have a friend. His father is Korean. Mother American, divorced and all that. But he's, you know, so half Korean. And he was all into, you know, K-pop and all that. And he actually won the United States, one of the positions for the United States K-pop. And they paid for him and his partner to go over to Korea and compete there for the, like, World K-pop Championship or whatever it is.
Wow.
He didn't win, but he won one of the top positions. I think they had, like, four competitions. He lost the first one. But he learned what went wrong, what they said, you know, the reason why they didn't win. So they practiced and perfected it, and they went to the one in New York City, and they won, and they went to the United States. So it, that's why I was wondering if you met Cy. I love Cy. I love the background story on Cy and all that. But and of course, you know, Gangnam Style.
Yeah. Oh my God, he's always going to be for that. What's crazy about Gangnam Style is that, like, how do you eclipse? I remember, like, you know, hearing an interview, and he's actually sad about Gangnam Style in some ways, because he thinks no matter what he does next, he's always going to be remembered for that.
That's true.
Right.
It is true.
So it's interesting. Yeah. When you go that big, that quick, you know, what do you do afterwards? So
I'd love to
maybe on my second book, I'll follow up and then cover him.
Yeah. So. It'd be like for American culture, it'd be like John Wayne leaving the Westerns and becoming, you know, like Columbo for the TV show or something. You know? Exactly. Nobody like, no, growing up, I was a Mission Impossible fan, the TV show Mission Impossible, Peter Graves.
Yep.
And when I was also brought up on Gunsmoke, the original Gunsmoke series, where James Arness is Matt Dillon. Well, before the TV series, it was on the radio, okay? It was a radio series. And when they got ready to transition to TV, the person playing Matt Dillon on the radio was William Conrad, a famous actor that weighed like 300 pounds, right? Not the picturesque image of the fighting lawman in the Old West. But, you know, on radio, he had the voice. So they opened up auditions, and Peter Graves won the audition. He was going to be hired as James Arness. They said, but we got one more guy we got to interview. But, you know, I mean, from what we've seen, you're the guy, right? But we got, you know, got one guy waiting out in the room. We got to interview him. The guy waiting was his brother, and it was James Arness. Peter Graves' real name is Peter Arness, right? So it was his brother that beat him for the title of Matt Dillon. And then, you know, Peter Graves ended up going to Mission Impossible. But, I love background stories. That's Cy, you know, that he started, you know, poor and doing these things. And Gangnam Style, for a lot of American people don't understand that Gangnam neighborhood is like the Beverly Hills of the United States. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's where all the rich people live. And then he's in there, you know, with the hip hop and all that. But that's getting away from your book.
No, it's a great story.
But what did you learn while writing this book?
I learned a lot about myself, actually. So, you know, a lot of it was like, why am I so, one of the things I just couldn't understand was like, why am I so different from my parents? Like, you know, I have this black duck image, and I always felt like I'm the ugly duckling. And believe me, I've had a lot of pressure as a kid, because I'm actually the first son for 5 generations now. So my grandparents showed me like where I'm going to get buried on the top of the hill where all the first sons get buried or whatever. And I had so much pressure. I had so much pressure as a kid, like, that I had to study. Like, I remember, you know, in middle school, I ran away from home a couple times because I didn't want to do my homework and whatnot. And I just hated it. And as I wrote this book, I started to realize my parents and I were just very different, because we grew up in different times. And I talk about it extensively in one of my chapters, chapter 13, where I talk about, you know, cultural opportunities in business. And I talk about how my parents, not only is there a cultural difference, but there's a socioeconomic difference. Yeah. So when they were growing up, they were extremely poor. This was just right after the Korean War, and they had to fight and scrap for everything. And it's almost like as if, you know, you have parents that grew up during the Great Depression, American, if I was an American. So instead of having like a 30-year gap, it's almost like a 60 to 90-year gap that I have with my parents on top of the cultural difference.
Yeah.
So when I look at America, I saw it as a land of opportunity. They thought of it as get an American education. It's a land of like this giant safety net, right? So one of the best things that ever happened writing this book was my parents finally accepted me for who I was. In fact, I didn't talk to my parents for about 2 years prior to writing the book because they just couldn't understand. Like, you could have gotten two PhDs by now living in a van, setting your butt off, and you would bring in so much prestige to the family. Why do you do this? And after they read the book, they're just so impressed. They finally understood me. And in fact, they're my biggest fans now of the book. I mean, they're buying it for all their friends. They talk about it nonstop. They call me every day how the book sales is going. Luckily, it's an Amazon bestseller for like 9 weeks now.
That's awesome.
They can't wait for it to get it translated in Korean, you know, all that stuff. Yeah. So, yeah, amen to that. That was amazing.
Yeah. I was going to ask how your relationship is now with your parents, you know, how they view you now. So that's good. That's good. Yeah, and what you're saying, you know, two PhDs while you're living in the van. I mean, I can imagine, you know, when they go to their little, you know, networking parties that, you know, the Koreans have that, you know, come on over for dinner and say, so what does your son do? Oh, he's living in a van in New York City or whatever. I imagine that those conversations were not pleasant. I was like, my son just finished, you know, his internship, and now he's, you know, he's Dr. So-and-so. What's your son do? He's living in a van with some friends.
down by the river. Yeah.
playing what's that song? Keep on Rolling.
Yeah. And it's so funny. It's like Asians only compete against Asians, especially Koreans only compete against Koreans. That's the funny part. So I come home and I tell mom, hey, mom, I was on CNBC. She's like, well, who cares? No Korean reads CNBC. She's like, I'm on the LA Times, whatever, New York Times, whatever. And then one day I'm just taking a shower and just like someone's just banging on the door like crazy. And then like, mom, what's going on? She's like, you're in the Korea Times. And she was just so happy. All the Koreans are going to know you now. And I'm just like, are you kidding me, mom? Like Korea Times. And it wasn't even like Korea. It's like Korea Times, the LA edition.
Yeah.
Just for the Los Angeles Korea. I'm like, mom, you're ridiculous. And I didn't know what to say.
That's awesome. That is awesome. How can people purchase your book?
Just go to Amazon. And, you know, right now I have a special going on for the ebook. It's only 99 cents until the audiobook comes out in a couple of weeks. And then the audiobook will be out in a little bit. I think the paperback is like $14 and the audiobook would be about $17. But yeah, if you want to just take a glimpse at it, you know, the ebook would be the way to go.
All right. And what's your website that people could look at and look you up?
Outlierapproach.com.
Outlierapproach. I'm putting this on the show notes.com. Okay. Mm-hmm. And if someone wanted to get a hold of you, maybe do an interview or something like this, how can they do that?
Just email me, kevinhshong@gmail.com.
All right. Well, Kevin, I appreciate you taking the time out of your busy schedule today. I know that our listeners are going to be blessed by this. I mean, I was just blessed by the story because I can relate to every aspect of what you were talking about. I joined the military straight out of high school where I was expected to go to college, you know? So, I mean, I understand some of those things as well, but, your story is an inspiration. Your book is absolutely great. I highly recommend, folks, recommend that you go on Amazon.com and type in, you know, Outlier Approach and buy the book or get the ebook. You know, he's got it on sale right now. You get it while you can. It's a blessing just to see the commitment that Kevin put into building his business. You know, it's that type of commitment to actually make the decision, we're going to make this work. In order to do it, we got to consolidate funds. We're going to live in a van. I mean, that's guts, but he who sows also reaps, and it worked. I mean, look at him now. Amen. Kevin, I appreciate you. I appreciate the time that you've given us today, and I wish you all the best and pray God's blessings upon your business, man. You're awesome.
Thank you so much for having me, Pastor Bob, and I really enjoy being on the show. Amen.
Amen. Folks, that's all the time we have for today. For Kevin Hong and myself, this is Pastor Bob reminding you to be blessed in all that you do.